Bienvenidos. It's Cinco de Mayo, 2026, and this is the Arizona Daily Star, brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant. And filling up most of the front page with photographs and large print is U.S. AIDS ships in strait. U.S. says it has started to guide out ships through the Strait of Hormuz. This is from Parisa Hafezi, Ahmed Tolba, and Idris Ali of Reuters. The U.S. military said two U.S. Navy guided missile destroyers had entered the Gulf to break an Iranian blockade and that two U.S. merchant ships had transited the Strait of Hormuz after Iran said it had prevented a U.S. warship from entering the Gulf. U.S. Central Command said its forces were supporting President Donald Trump's Project Freedom, which aims to guide out commercial ships stranded in the Gulf by the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and were enforcing a blockade of Iranian ports. The intervention appeared to raise the risk of a direct confrontation between the U.S. and Iran in a waterway that usually carries a fifth of the world's seaborne oil and gas, but has been blocked for 2 months as a result of the war. CENTCOM said that two U.S.-flagged merchant vessels had crossed through the strait as the U.S. destroyers operated in the Gulf, adding, American forces are actively assisting efforts to restore transit for commercial shipping. Earlier, Tehran said it had forced a U.S. warship to turn back from the strait, although CENTCOM quickly denied a report from Iran's semi-official Fars news agency that two missiles had hit the ship near the Iranian port of Jask. A senior Iranian official told Reuters Iran had fired a warning shot and that it was unclear whether the warship had been damaged. Shipping industry awaits clarity on safety of strait. Oil prices had jumped 5% on reports that the warship being turned back, but later gave up half of that. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told Fox News that the U.S. had absolute control of the strait. But the shipping industry remains to be convinced that the vital oil route, whose closure has damaged global business and trade, is safe to use, with little sign of progress towards a negotiated resolution of Washington's conflict with Iran. Iran's Navy said it had prevented American Zionist warships from entering the strait with a swift and decisive warning. Trump gave few details of his plan to aid ships and their crews who have been confined to the Gulf and are running low on food and other supplies. We have told these countries that we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways so that they can freely and ably get on with their business, he told in a post on Truth Social on Sunday. In response, Iran's unified command told commercial ships and oil tankers, we have repeatedly said the security of the Strait of Hormuz is in our hands and that the safe passage of vessels needs to be coordinated with the armed forces. We warn that any foreign armed forces, especially the aggressive U.S. Army, will be attacked if they intend to approach and enter the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has blocked nearly all shipping into and out of the Gulf, apart from its own, since the start of the war, sending oil prices soaring by 50% or more. CENTCOM said it would support Trump's Project Freedom with 15,000 military personnel and more than 100 land and sea-based aircraft, plus warships and drones. It was not immediately clear how the operation would work. It will not necessarily include naval escorts of commercial ships, Axios reporter Barak Ravid said on X. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump said that any interference with the U.S. operation would be dealt with forcefully. Ships stuck for months. However, the Joint Maritime Information Center, led by U.S. Maritime Forces based in Bahrain, told operators in a note that the U.S. had established an enhanced security area to support Strait of Hormuz transits. It advised vessels to use Omani waters on the west side of the strait to avoid mines, urging them to carefully review risk assessments and routing ahead of transit. Hundreds of commercial vessels and as many as 20,000 seafarers have been unable to transit the strait during the conflict, the International Maritime Organization says. The shipping container group, Hapag-Lloyd, said on Monday it considered the transit through the strait was still not possible. Shipping and oil executives have said they need to and an agreed and full end of hostilities before military convoys alone are not enough to allow normal traffic to resume safely. The United Arab Emirates on Monday accused Iran of attacking an empty crude oil tanker belonging to the Abu Dhabi state oil firm ADNOC with drones as it attempted to pass through the strait. In a rare piece of good news, Pakistan said the U.S. had handed over 22 crew members from an Iranian container vessel that the American forces seized last month. Pakistan, which has been trying to broker a peace deal, described the move as confidence building. Iran reviews U.S. response to peace proposal. The United States and Israel suspended their bombing campaign against Iran 4 weeks ago, and U.S. and Iranian officials have held one round of face-to-face talks, but attempts to set up further meetings have failed. Iranian state media said on Sunday, Washington had conveyed its response to a 14-point Iranian proposal via Pakistan, and that Tehran was now reviewing it. A senior Iranian official has confirmed that the proposal envisaged ending the war on all fronts, including Israel's attacks on Lebanon, and resolving the shipping standoff first while leaving talks on Iran's nuclear program for later. Washington wants Tehran to give up its stockpile of more than 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which the United States said could power a bomb. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful, although it is willing to discuss some curbs in return for the lifting of sanctions. It had accepted such curbs in a 2015 deal that Trump abandoned. Trump is under pressure to break Iran's hold on the strait to try to prevent soaring gasoline prices from causing a voter backlash against his Republican Party in the midterm congressional elections in November. Below the fold, right under that story, is Doomed to Die. One man chose a risky experiment that changed history. It's from Karen Weintraub of the USA Today Network, Boston. Tim Andrews was so close to death, he was ready to risk what little life he might have left. The retired grocery store manager was told that he would have to wait 5 years before reaching the top of the transplant list and qualifying for a new life-saving kidney. He knew he wasn't going to make it. Already, he could no longer walk or hold down food. So last year, he volunteered for an experimental surgery at the leading edge of scientific research. He agreed to get a pig kidney to replace his own failing organ. I'm going to die anyway, so why shouldn't I do something for all these other people with kidney disease that are suffering, said Andrews of Concord, New Hampshire. I don't care if I die the next day, as long as you learn something, he told his doctor. One pig and one human kidney transplant later, Andrews, 68, says he is now thinking of his future in terms of decades instead of days. I'm laughing again, Andrews chuckled, remembering his time as a self-proclaimed pig man. In the process, Andrews has become an example of how far transplantation has come and what it could look like in the future, when there are enough organs for everyone in need and when the medication that enables a transplant's success doesn't threaten a recipient's long-term survival. Andrews' success as a transplant patient represents a decades-long American journey, one of many that USA Today is profiling as a part of its coverage of the United States' 250th anniversary year. The first ever successful organ transplant took place in 1954, just a few miles away from where Andrews received his own. The distance the field has traveled since, and has yet to go, represents a remarkable and very American medical journey. characterized by big ideas, big risks, perseverance, and issues of fairness and eye-popping prices. The result, Andrews is alive and much healthier than he was 2 years ago. "Oh my God, I'm in a science fiction movie," said Andrews, chuckling again, adding he's always been a sci-fi buff. "But how did I end up here?" The wait for an organ. More than 100,000 Americans now sit in an organ transplant list, and most of them are waiting for a kidney. Like Andrews, they worry that they won't last long enough to get that ultimate gift. For kidneys and some liver transplants, live donation is possible. That is, someone can donate one of their two kidneys as part or a part of their liver and live out the rest of their lives normally. But not everyone can find a living match among friends, relatives, or total strangers. Andrews, like many, eventually benefited from a deceased organ donor. Only about 3 in 1,000 people die in a way that allows them to donate an organ like a kidney, lungs, or a heart. The science is getting better, enabling more organs to be used from patients who die older, sicker, or further from a hospital. "We're expanding the pool by using what we used to call marginal organs," said Dr. Nehal Elias, surgical director for kidney transplantation at Massachusetts General Hospital, where Andrews had his surgeries. "But at the end of the day, dead people are dead for a reason. Young, healthy people don't just drop dead. There are simply not enough organs for the people who need them," Elias and other experts say. That's where the idea of using pig organs comes from. For decades, researchers have been working towards the goal of using animal organs to save people. Some view the trade as unethical. But Americans already eat more than 130 million pigs every year, and pig, cow, and even shark tissues have been used in medical settings. Pig organs are similar enough in size and function to humans, but transplanting entire organs was completely out of reach until about a decade ago, when scientists began mastering gene editing well enough to breed pigs whose organs are less likely to be rejected by the human immune system. But xenotransplantation, as it's known, is still very much a work in progress, with just 10 Americans, including Andrews, having undergone a transplant. Only 6 are still alive. Andrews holds the record as of this writing. He lived 271 days with a pig organ. Clinical trials started in 2026 to test pig organs in more people. The goal, doctors say, is to count their survival in years, not days. The advances in organs available and the promise of what's to come are making this the golden age of transplantation, said Dr. Shimul Shah, clinical director and chief of transplant surgery at the Massachusetts Mass General Brigham Transplant Center. "It's never been a better time to be in transplantation," Shaw said. "Right now, we're blowing up and expanding what we can do. 10 years ago, there was nothing like this." The first organ transplant ever. Back in the fall of 1954, doctors were afraid they'd never get organ transplantation to work. Surgeons in Boston had recently tried and failed to give 11 people new organs. Those who survived the surgery died when their own immune systems rejected the new organs. They had no idea if Richard Herrick's fate would be any different. Herrick, then 23, was in end-stage kidney failure, likely triggered by the scarlet fever he suffered as a child. Doctors at Boston's Peter Bent Brigham Hospital thought maybe they could get a transplant to work in Richie because he had a twin brother, Ronald. Nobody was sure if the twins were identical or fraternal. There was no such thing as genetic testing back then. Watson and Crick had only discovered DNA the year before. But surely, they hoped, the two boys had been born at the same time might trigger less immune reaction from a shared kidney. The medical establishment was critical of what the Brigham doctors were considering, with one colleague calling them a bunch of fools for even considering the risky surgery. "The whole idea, I must admit, was first very distressing to me," Virginia Herrick, the boy's aunt, later wrote in the Saturday Evening Post. She and nearly everyone she told about the situation had the same mixture of horror and pity. Horror at the idea of asking a strong young man to make such a sacrifice when the outcome was so entirely unknown, and pity for the sick brother who seemed doomed to die before he could reach the prime of life. The night before the scheduled surgery, with the boys on different floors of the hospital, Richie sent his healthy brother a note. "You get out of here and go home." "I am here and I'm going to stay here," came the defiant reply. The surgery was a success, and both boys were home at the family's dairy farm in western Massachusetts a few weeks later. There are so many hopeful signs that eventually the problem relating to troublesome individual differences may be solved, their aunt concluded, and that a great many lives might be saved by prompt replacement of a sick or worn-out kidney or other organ by a healthy one. Dr. Joseph Murray, the plastic surgeon who led the Herrick's transplant, first got interested in transplantation when he saw World War II victims survive burns with skin grafts. He continued to work on the problem of immune rejection in transplant patients for decades, leading clinical research on medications that made organ transplants possible, first in twins, then between people who weren't so closely related, and then from deceased donors. He won the Nobel Prize in 1990. The transplant science that Murray pioneered is practiced in every major city in the country and all over the world, but doctors today are still dealing with the challenges of immunosuppression. Every day on the medication that keeps a body's immune system from attacking a new organ, you're not getting healthier, you're getting closer to developing cancer and heart disease, and eventually it has its side effects on the kidneys, said Dr. Tatsuo Kawai, a transplant surgeon and director of Mass General's Legarota Center for the Clinical Transplant Tolerance. "The medication that's necessary for survival is toxic," said Kawai, a national leader in finding safer ways to circumvent the body's immune protections. Ronald Herrick, the healthy twin, marked the 50th anniversary of his brother's transplant with Murray in 2004. Richie Herrick died of a heart attack 8 years later after his surgery, likely caused by his years of illness. But he did survive long enough to marry his nurse and have two children. Challenges outside the operating room. Not every person with advanced heart disease has an equal shot at a new organ. Not everyone in America has an equal likelihood of needing one. Some people lose the genetic lottery and end up requiring a replacement organ, often at a young age. The way the donor system is set up, people in certain parts of the country have to be sicker to make it to the top of the list than those in other areas. People with limited access to medical care, exercise, and healthy food are more likely to develop diseases that land them in poor enough health need to need a organ. Even making it onto the list can be a challenge. Disease has to be caught early enough for a transplant to make a difference. People who live alone, who have no family support, aren't considered good candidates for transplantation, and doctors are directed to leave them off the list if they don't meet the qualifications. Andrew's sister, Taffy Johnson, moved in with him into a condo to help with recovery. Without that commitment, the divorcee may not have been eligible for a new organ. Everyone involved acknowledges that the system isn't fair, and perhaps there's no way to make it that way. Still, Jasmine Evans was shocked when she was told she'd waited 5 years longer for a kidney than she should have. Evans, a black woman, was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease in late 2011 after a routine high school physical. It was managed with medication for years, but by 2019, she was put on the organ transplant list and started some home dialysis, which uses a machine to detoxify the blood, taking over the role of the kidneys. In 2023, the same year she got a successful transplant, she received a letter from the hospital where she'd had her surgery. She should have been able to get it 4 years earlier. An algorithm used to determine where to put people on the transplant list had mischaracterized black patients since 1999. A faulty study had found that black people had more muscle mass and therefore more reserves than white people, so they had to be sicker to make it to the top of the list. Evans realized she had endured four more years of headaches, crushing fatigue, loss of appetite than if she had had a different skin color. A doctoral student at Temple University at the time, Evans reworked her thesis around what she learned, focusing on the role of clinical trials and decision-making tools in medical outcomes for black Americans. "I'm hopeful about the direction we're going in," Evans told USA Today. "There are people fighting for a change, allowing more perspective to come into the conversation." At 20 minutes past the hour, let's move to national and world news. U.S. to move forward with EU tariff increase. Officials say it's a result of non-compliance with an earlier deal. This is from Reuters, Washington. U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer told European Union and German trade officials over the weekend that the U.S. will move forward with President Donald Trump's plan to raise EU car import tariffs to 25%, according to a statement Monday on CNBC. "I was in contact with both European and German trade officials this weekend to help them understand why this is happening and remind them of all the conversations we've had about their compliance," Greer told CNBC in an interview. "I'll continue to have these conversations, but the president's moving forward with this action. Asked if the tariff should be considered just a piece of larger negotiation or a permanent state, Greer said, "It's one part of the deal." Trump said on Friday he would increase tariffs on cars from the European Union to 25% next week, that's this week, from the previously agreed 15%, saying the bloc had not complied with its trade deal with Washington. The European Commission rejected Trump's claim that Brussels was not complying with last year's trade deal and said it would keep its options open to protect EU interests. War in Ukraine. Sides declare temporary ceasefire. Putin warns against disruptions to Russia's Victory Day celebration. Reuters. Moscow. President Vladimir Putin declared a two-day ceasefire Monday in the conflict with Ukraine from May 8th to 9th to mark Russia's World War II victory. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky countered with his own proposed pause in fighting starting earlier from the night of May 5th and 6th. Putin first spoke of a possible ceasefire coinciding with commemorations of the 81st anniversary of the victory in a phone conversation last week with President Donald Trump. Ukraine had long been wary of the notion of a brief ceasefire rather than moves towards a prolonged end to fighting. Russia's defense ministry, in a post on Telegram, announced the two-day May 8th and 9th truce, and it expected that Ukraine should follow suit. It said Moscow's forces would take all measures to ensure the safety of commemorations marking the defeat of Germany in World War II. It warned, however, any attempt by Ukraine to disrupt the celebrations would prompt retaliation. In the event of attempts by the Kiev regime to implement its criminal plans to disrupt the celebration of the 81st anniversary of victory in the Great Patriotic War, the armed forces of the Russian Federation will launch a retaliatory massive missile attack on the center of Kiev, it said. Russia, it said, hadn't been in a position to launch such an attack before, but had previously refrained from some such actions on humanitarian grounds. "We are warning the civilian population of Kiev and staff at foreign diplomatic missions of the need to leave the city in a timely manner," it said. Zelensky, writing on Telegram, after attending a European political community summit in Armenia, said Ukraine would observe a ceasefire beginning midnight Tuesday. He said Russia failed to respond to Kiev's long-standing calls for a lasting ceasefire, adding that Ukraine was acting because human life is incomparably comparably more valuable than the celebration of any anniversary. In this regard, we announce the regime of silence starting from 0 hour on the night of May 5th through May 6th, he wrote. Zelensky gave no time frame for the ceasefire, but said that Ukraine would act symmetrically from the specified moment. Russia proclaimed a brief ceasefire last month for Orthodox Easter, but each side accused the other of violating it. And in the News Digest, medics evacuate two cruise ship passengers. Amsterdam. Medics were working Monday to evacuate two people with symptoms of the deadly hantavirus after a suspected outbreak on a luxury cruise ship held off West Africa carrying mostly British, American, and Spanish passengers, officials said. About 150 people were stuck on the vessel after three people, a Dutch couple and a German national, died, and some others fell ill, including a Briton who left the vessel and was being treated in South Africa, authorities said. The Netherlands National Institute for Public Health and the Environment said the hantavirus had been confirmed in one of the patients showing symptoms. A source briefed on the matter said the Dutch woman who died tested positive for the virus as well. Musk SEC settles suit over Twitter purchase. Washington. Elon Musk settled the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission's civil lawsuit accusing the world's richest person of waiting too long in 2022 to disclose his initial purchase of Twitter, now known as X. A trust in Musk's name will pay a $1.5 million civil fine under the settlement disclosed on Monday in the Washington, D.C. federal court. Musk did not admit wrongdoing and won't have to give up any of the $150 million he allegedly saved from the delay. The settlement requires approval by the U.S. District Judge Sparkle Suknanen, who in February rejected Musk's bid to dismiss the case. Briefly, AgriStats, the U.S. Department of Justice, plans to settle its case against data company AgriStats with an agreement officials hope will help drive down food costs. White House advisor Peter Navarro said Monday, the DOJ alleges that AgriStats' weekly reports on meat pricing enabled anti-competitive practices in the chicken, pork, and turkey industries. Citgo. The United States extended a license that protects Venezuelan-owned refiner Citgo Petroleum from creditors through June 19th, according to a statement on the U.S. Treasury Department's website Monday. The general license, issued by the Office of Foreign Assets Control, is meant to encourage investment and boost oil output in Venezuela. Nigeria. At least 130 Nigerian citizens in South Africa asked to be flown home following protests targeting foreigners. Nigerian Foreign Minister Bianca Ojukwu said the applicants are the first under a new Nigerian government-assisted repatriation scheme. Brazil. Former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro was discharged from a hospital Monday after undergoing surgery on his right shoulder on Friday. His doctor told reporters, Bolsonaro has been under humanitarian house arrests since last Monday for plotting a coup. Berlin. Two people were killed and three others were injured Monday when a car drove into a pedestrian zone of Leipzig, Germany. Police arrested the driver, identifying him as a 33-year-old man with German citizenship. Spirit Airlines. Spirit Airlines asked a U.S. bankruptcy court for approval to pay $10.7 million in retention bonuses to remaining employees and said it had no choice but to end operations. The airline said it will retain about 150 employees before decreasing its headcount to about 40 after 3 months. And now, moving to Tucson and regional news, can a pipeline quench thirsty AZ? This is from Joan Miners of Arizona Republic. Every time tension over water shortages on the Colorado River ratchets up, a version of the same question surfaces. If the eastern half of the U.S. keeps flooding while the western U.S. is drying up, can't we just build a pipeline and balance it all out? At its core, this is a climate change conundrum, if ever there was one. In each report released over recent decades by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a recurring collaboration between hundreds of scientists from around the world, one of the most consistent and certain findings has been that a warming atmosphere is resulting in wet places getting wetter and dry places getting drier. The appealingly simple solution for a brilliant species with engineering tools of just refilling the depleted Colorado River system with overflows from eastern rivers has been considered many times. In May 2021, when storage at Lake Powell fell lower than before the reservoir was first filled in 1980, a long-distance water transfer option was confronted and dismissed as wildly out of touch by the Arizona Republic's water opinion writer. The concept still hit mainstream channels that September when liberal-leaning commentator Bill Maher floated the idea. The following August, as new record lows at Lake Powell failed to rise substantially after snowmelt, the debate about importing Mississippi River water reappeared and was explored at great length by the Desert Sun's Janet Wilson. She consulted water experts, conservation groups, and government officials who told her that, while technically feasible, a cross-country water pipeline would be prohibitively expensive, legally complex, and too slow for near-term relief, and would essentially constitute swapping one ecological catastrophe for another. One of her readers wrote in to advocate for moving dissatisfied desert dwellers east to the water instead. Yet, as Wilson wrote, the viral and zany proposals refuse to die. So, as Arizona faces its most dire outlook on access to Colorado River water, yet, it seemed that only a matter of time before the pipeline idea bobbed back into view. With the federal government finally making moves to manage basin flows that, given this year's paltry snowpack, are predicted to drop Lake Powell below the minimal level needed for hydropower generation by this fall, the political and logistical puzzle of Western water security hovers at a boiling point. In March, Lisa Nelson, a Phoenix resident and Arizona Republic reader, who okayed us with her sharing her name, wrote in to ask, have AZ leaders approached other states that have overabundant amount of water and possibly flooding zones to develop a type of channel or aqueduct or pipeline to move water to areas in Arizona facing water shortages? This would obviously be a huge investment, but if it can be done with oil and gas, then it should be possible with water. It seems like a no-brainer solution that addresses two expensive problems, how to deal with water shortage areas and how to manage an area with too much of it. Sure, it would be hard, but ancient civilizations did it, and other countries are doing it now. Well, Nelson is right that other countries and civilizations have undertaken piping water at long distances to address both flooding and drought. China's North-South Water Transfer Project is currently the world's largest such effort, diverting billions of cubic meters of water over thousands of miles each year via several routes, and some are still under construction. At a cost of $70 billion, the project was successfully redistributed water resources to areas in need. Along the way, it has dramatically altered natural ecosystems, introducing new diseases and parasites to previously unafflicted landscapes and destabilizing local fish and aquatic networks with unpredictable ways. The construction also displaced innumerable species and humans to clear the way for a massive infrastructure fix to an even larger atmospheric problem. Recently published peer-reviewed research papers have determined that while China's SNWTP has temporarily improved water access for about 150 million people. The project's ever-escalating costs, environmental concerns, and water rebound effects have disincentivized smart use may soon outstrip its advantages. In the United States, traditionally stricter environmental laws that require assessment of potential damages and prevent government initiatives from automatically bulldozing through private and public lands have put domestic guardrails on such large-scale water pipelines. The enormous expense and energy required to pump water, which is heavier and less profitable than oil or gas, up and over mountain ranges, has also always been penciled out as politically and economically unpalatable. Kyle Roerink, executive director of the Great Basin Water Network, an organization that works to promote water conservation in the West, has opposed several water pipeline projects and says that exporting water from the Mississippi Delta will never be a sensible or reasonable solution. His list of explanations include the astronomical cost, stemming from eminent domain, permitting, construction, water management, and staffing fees, and the intractability of managing healthy water quality over such vast distances with so many pollution inputs. The southeastern states may also not be as eager to get rid of their water as Arizonans might assume. Coastal erosion due to climate-worsened hurricanes, drilling, and other factors mean that the Mississippi Delta needs all the sediment transported downstream by its major rivers. The Mississippi's flow plays a role, too, in diluting agricultural chemicals caused by causing hypoxic dead zones in the Gulf as the region navigates its own experiences with unpredictable drought. On top of these broad limitations, which in entities across the aisle, including the Goldwater Institute, have deemed cost prohibitive, as well as practically environmentally infeasible, there are complex legal water rights obstacles that run deeper than the administration's ability to override. The issue of water rights management would be a Byzantine nightmare for such a large-scale project, Roerink told the Republic. The Mississippi isn't adjudicated but under one set of laws. It is governed under many doctrines in many states. Just as in the West, eastern states have differing state laws governing water allocations in their respective jurisdictions. There are mixes of riparian and appropriation doctrines governing use. The legal framework leads me to believe that the only thing this pipeline would be good for are lawyers who practice at the U.S. Supreme Court. Weather experts, AZ, could see a rainy summer. This is from Paige Moore of the Arizona Republic. AccuWeather has released its annual summer weather predictions, giving Arizonans an idea of how the weather might look heading into June, July, and August. Overall, AccuWeather predicts extreme weather circumstances across the United States this summer, with some parts suffering drought and other parts experiencing flash flooding. According to AccuWeather, Arizona will have a wet and hot summer, even putting the state at a low or moderate risk of flooding at times, which could also improve the drought across the state. Here's an in-depth look at Arizona's weather according to AccuWeather. When is summer? Summer officially starts Sunday, June 21st, 2026. Will it be hotter this summer in Arizona? Overall, AccuWeather predicts most of the United States will have temperatures above historical highs. In Arizona, the north, northwest, and southwest parts of the states will receive temperatures 1 to 2 degrees above the historical average, according to AccuWeather. The rest of the states can expect temperatures close to historical averages. However, Arizonans can expect summer weather to start early, with peak temperatures as early as June or July across the state. Will it rain this summer in Arizona? Arizona should expect a hot and wet summer. Nearly the whole state should expect 150% of normal precipitation, except for the northeast corner of the state. High precipitation will also lead to an improvement in Arizona's drought across the whole state. Yet, AccuWeather notes that there's still a chance of drought in the northeast part of Arizona. the southwestern quarter of the state was at risk of some flooding, and the rest of the state was at moderate risk. How does AccuWeather make its predictions? AccuWeather uses databases from around the world to collect weather forecasts in real time, then digitally processes the data to collect trends of weather happening in certain areas historically, according to the company. By using this process to collect data for the last 30 years and pairing it with meteorological insight, AccuWeather says it's able to give accurate long-range weather predictions. And now at 20 minutes before the hour, let's move to the lifestyle section with hints from Heloise. Avoid lingering odors in your garbage cans. Dear Heloise, trash cans can develop odors even after you empty them, but a quick step can keep smells under control. Sprinkle a thin layer of baking soda at the bottom of the can before adding a new bag. The baking soda absorbs odors throughout the week. After noticing lingering smells in my kitchen, I added this to my routine, and it made a noticeable difference right away. For extra freshness, wipe the inside of the can occasionally with a mild cleaner. This is from Mark E. in Columbus, Ohio. Foggy mirrors. Dear Heloise, foggy bathroom mirrors can slow down your morning routine, so here's a simple trick to keep them clear. Rub a small amount of shaving cream onto the mirror, then wipe it off with a clean cloth, which leaves behind a thin layer which prevents fog from forming. I was tired of wiping the mirror after every shower, and now it stays clear enough to get ready without interruptions. I repeat the process every few days. This is from Dana R. in Hartford, Connecticut. Thinking ahead. Dear Heloise, I purchase 2 half-gallons of milk and freeze one. This saves me the trouble of going to the grocery store when I'm out of milk for my coffee, especially when it's all I need from the store. This is from Beth in California. Keep herbs fresh longer. Dear Heloise, fresh herbs can wilt quickly if they sit in the fridge for too long. I started treating them look like flowers, and it made a big difference. I trimmed the stems slightly and placed the herbs in a glass with a little water. Then I cover it loosely with a plastic bag and store it in the refrigerator. The herbs stay hydrated and fresh for days longer. Changing the water every couple days to keep things clean. Some herbs, like basil, do better at room temperature, so just adjust as needed. It's a simple way to stretch your grocery budget and keep meals tasting fresh. This is from Paula H. in Savannah, Georgia. Loosen stuck-on lids. Dear Heloise, stubborn jar lids can be frustrating, especially when nothing seems to work, but a quick tap usually does the trick. Gently tap the edge of the lid against the counter to break the seal, then twist it open. You can run the lid under warm water for a few seconds to help it expand. I started doing this after struggling with a jar of pasta sauce that refused to budge. Now I don't waste time wrestling with lids. A better grip from a rubber band can also help if needed. This simple approach saves efforts and avoids the risk of spills. It's from Kevin R. in Des Moines, Iowa. Freshen leftover pizza. Dear Heloise, cold pizza never tastes the same the next day, but reheating it in a skillet brings back the crisp texture. Here's how to do it. Place a slice in a pan over medium heat, then cover for 1 or 2 minutes. The crust crisps up while the cheese melts evenly. I tried this after getting tired of soggy microwave pizza. Now leftovers taste much closer to fresh. For extra help, add a few drops of water to the pan before covering it to create steam. This is a quick fix that makes leftovers worth looking forward to. Tony M. in Newark, New Jersey. And you can send a money-saving or time-saving hint to Heloise with an H at Heloise.com. And today in history, Tuesday, May 5th, 1821, Napoleon Bonaparte died in exile on the island of St. Helena. 1862, outnumbered Mexican forces repelled French troops at the Battle of Puebla. The victory gave rise to the celebration of Cinco de Mayo, which later evolved in the United States to a celebration of Mexican heritage. 1891, Carnegie Hall in New York, then known as the Music Hall, opened with a concert. The performance was at first conducted by Walter Domrosch, director of the New York Symphony Orchestra, but after the administration, it was conducted by Peter Tchaikovsky, but they don't say here what the what was on the program. 1921, the Chanel No. 5 perfume was first released in Coco Chanel's Paris boutique. 1955, United States, France, and England ended their occupation of West Germany. 1961, Alan Shepard became the first American to travel in space. The suborbital flight of Shepard and Freedom 7 spacecraft lasted 15 minutes before a splashdown in the Atlantic Ocean. In 1967, the novel 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez was first published, telling a multi-generational tale of a family in Colombia as developments in the wider world encroach on their town. 1978, the first Ben & Jerry's ice cream shop opened in Burlington, Vermont. And now, Royal Stars from Georgia Nichols. Happy birthday for Tuesday, May 5th, 2026. You're self-assured, helpful, and concerned about others. You share your strong opinions. This is a slower-paced year. It's okay to rest. Take time to rejuvenate your energy and your outlook. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. This is a tricky day. Don't get on your high horse about something and try to push your views on a friend, group, or organization. Tonight, you're admired. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. Today, Mercury is in your sign and at odds with Pluto, which can make you obsessed about an idea. You might be preoccupied with something all day. Tonight, learn and explore. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Today, you might have the proverbial bee in your bonnet and can't let go of an idea. You might be focused on subjects that deal with hidden manners or covert aspects, perhaps psychology, magic, or the occult. Tonight, check your finances. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Tread carefully when talking to friends, groups, or organizations today. You might be so excited about an idea, you just won't let it go. Tonight, listen and cooperate. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. This is a poor day to defend your position with a parent, boss, or any member of authority, including the police. Tonight, get organized. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Don't get hung up on political, religious, or racial issues today. You might be obsessed with an idea and you can't let it go. Seems to be a theme. Take a breath and step backwards. Caution, because issues with kids and romantic partners might be confusing. Tonight, socialize. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. Don't make a big deal about anything during family discussions today because the issues are vague. Tonight, relax. Scorpio, you're the most forceful sign in the zodiac. Don't come on too strong today talking to others. You might be tempted to do so because you're super focused on something. Tonight, an interesting conversation. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. You might be pushy at work today because you think you have a great idea, perhaps an improvement, but others might not agree. Tonight, check your money. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. Parents need to be understanding with dealing with their kids today. Don't force an issue because people can be obsessed about their ideas and their approaches to things today. But tonight, you win. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Steer clear of arguments with family members today. You might look foolish. This is because you're obsessed about an idea, which is not too skillful. Tonight, enjoy privacy. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Avoid arguments with relatives, neighbors, and siblings today. Do your best to keep an open mind and not be obsessed with one idea. Tonight, be friendly. And on to sports. High school student athlete of the week, Kaylee living in Tucson. Kaylee George making waves for IRHS volleyball program. And that's where my two sons graduated from. This is by Justin Spears of Arizona Daily Star. There's no strict freshman program in the Ironwood Ridge High School volleyball program, but exceptions were made for Kaylee George. George became a starter right away for the Nighthawks, said head coach Bill Lang, and she quickly became one of the faces of Ironwood Ridge's beach volleyball and indoor volleyball programs. We have a long-standing tradition that freshmen don't make our varsity team, said Lang, who coaches both of Ironwood Ridge's volleyball programs. That's mostly because our enrollment is so massive that the juniors and seniors we had were so good, not only on court, but in their maturity level. It's what you'd expect. Freshmen don't usually hit that bar with maturity, work ethic, and talent. But Kaylee came in and she was ahead of the curve. She looked everyone in the eye when she spoke. That's one of my non-negotiables. When I talk to you, you need to look at me. Some of those kids in the COVID era don't have that skill set anymore. Kaylee has been around some pretty good coaches, so she came in with the ability to look me in the eye. She's always been different that way. Now, they show a photograph of her holding the volleyball, but she's got a pair of sunglasses on, so I can't see her eyes. As an indoor volleyball player, George is one of the top players in Southern Arizona as an outside hitter and has 770 kills, 523 digs, and 438 points in her two-year career at Ironwood Ridge. She was second on the team with 455 kills this past season. Lang said the springy George handles the ball and she does a good job of reading the game. She watches what is happening, she makes predictions, and she's steady enough to go after it, added the Ironwood Ridge coach. Her ability to read the game and then add to her athletic ability, even though she's undersized, makes her a pretty good player. When she's jumping, she hits the ball at the height. Ironwood Ridge's beach volleyball season came to an end with a 4-1 loss to Flagstaff in the Division II semifinals. IRHS ended the season with an 11-3 record, the same record as George's combined record with freshman Marcella Landers and senior Maria Lamas. George is a combined 23-6 since last year. I'm really proud of our team, George said. We have a goal of making it to the state championship, and we still had a deep run. George and Landers are competing in the Division II Open Division State Championship this week in Castile High School in Queen Creek. The sixth-seeded George and Landers, who are Iron Ridge's only tandem in the field, will play their first match on Tuesday. If they win, they'll likely face number 3 Scottsdale Saguaro's tandem of Sloane Kribel and Nyla Bibby, a U of A volleyball commit and daughter of former Arizona basketball star Mike Bibby. The championship match is set for Thursday evening. Gone to the beach. George started playing volleyball as early as she can remember, and she played basketball too, and she gravitated towards volleyball after playing it consistently at a nearby YMCA. I'm very competitive, so it's really fun being on the court, George said. It's fun playing with my teammates, and I like getting pushed. I fell in love with it because it's a way for me to be competitive and play in a team sport. George, whose favorite subject in school is math, is also a standout student at IRHS and currently has a 4.4 GPA. She plans to study law and become a lawyer when she goes to college in 2 years. As she turns into an upperclassman, I definitely need to work on my leadership skills, George said. She's got all the tools to become a leader and arguably the best volleyball player in the Ironwood Ridge history. her competitive, her work ethic, and her ability to read. Those are the three things that separate her from a lot of good players, Lang said. We know that she's just going to get better. We know she's good. And when you come to a beach match, you're going to point at her. And you're going to come to an indoor match, and you're going to point at her. What I really want her to do now is make everyone around her better. Those players are rare. They don't happen all the time. But Kaylee is clearly one of our best players, and she can make everyone else better. That's my goal for her as she gets ready for her junior and senior campaign. And briefly, Arizona baseball. Wildcats no match for number one Kansas from Michael Lev of the Arizona Daily Star. Like most of the Big 12 conference, the Arizona baseball team proved no match for the red-hot Kansas. Wildcats lost 11-5 to the Jayhawks on Sunday at Hoagland Park in Lawrence, Kansas. It's the second time this season Arizona, which is 16-30, 7-17 in the Big 12, has been swept in a weekend series. Arizona softball, the U of A to take on ASU in Big 12 tournament from James Kelly, and that's a special to the Arizona Daily Star. The U of A softball team is limping into the postseason, slipping to third in the conference and setting up a first Big 12 tournament matchup with rival Arizona State. After number 20 Wildcats, who are 35-14 and 16-8 in the Big 12, lost their last two regular season games, they will face number 6 seed ASU, who are 38-16 and 11-13 on Thursday night in the Big 12 quarterfinals. After winning the first game with Utah by 5 runs, even with the aid of some Ute miscues, the Wildcats were outscored by a combined 15-3 on Saturday and Sunday. And thank you for listening on this Cinco de Mayo, May 5th, 2026. This has been the Arizona Daily Star, brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant.